mighty mind rush violently from the ship. They'll not be pleased, but they know we must catch the monsoon with a well-found ship, and they know they're in the Navy. They've chosen their cake and must lie on it.
You mean they cannot have their bed and eat it?
No, no, it's not quite that, neither. I mean, I wish you wouldn't confuse my mind, Stephen. I mean, it's only a week or so to snap up everything that can be moved before a Thalian or Revenge come in, screeching for spars and cables. Then I dare say we can take it easier with native corkers from the yard and some liberty for our people. But there's a vast deal of work to be done. You saw her spurketing. Weeks and weeks of work, and we must hurry. From his earliest acquaintance with the Navy, Stephen had been oppressed by this sense of hurry. Hurry to look over the next horizon. Hurry to reach a certain port. Hurry to get away from it in case something should be happening in the distant strait. And hurry now not only to gather rose pods, but to catch the monsoon. If they didn't set the envoy down in Kampong by a given date, Jack would be obliged to beat all the way back against headwinds, losing months of valuable time, time that might be spent in active warfare. "Why," cried he, "the war might be over before we round the Cape if we miss the northeast monsoon. A pretty state of affairs." And in the immediate future there was this matchless opportunity for making the dear surprise what she had been and what she ought to be again. Stephen cared for none of these things. The fire that vainly urged Jack to go ashore burnt with a devouring and irresistible force in him. He left Jack caressing a massive baulk of timber, the finest teak in the island. He said, "My patients are in the hospital. Mr. Stanhope is recovering with the governor. There is no place for me here. I must devote a certain amount of time to the shore. A variety of reasons require my presence on the shore."
"I dare say you must,"
said Jack absently. "Mr. Babington, Mr. Babington! Where is that infernal slow belly of a carpenter?"
I dare say you must.
"But however busy you are, don't miss the getting out of our lower masts. We go along the sheer hulk, and they lift out like kiss my hand. It's the prettiest thing in the world. I shall send my word the day before. You'd be very sorry to miss the sheer hulk." Stephen came aboard from time to time, once with a mathematical Parsee, who wished to see the frigate's navigation tables, once with a child of unknown race, who had found him lost among the blue buffaloes of the Angier Maidan, in danger of being trampled, and who had led him back by the hand, talking all the way in an Urdu adapted to the meanest understanding, and once with a Chinese master mariner, a Christian from Macau, a spoilt priest with whom he conversed in Latin, showing him the working of the patent chain pump. And now and then he appeared at Jack's lodgings, where, in theory, he too had his bed and board. Jack was too discreet to ask him where he slept when they didn't meet, and too well-bred to comment on the fact that sometimes he walked about in a towel, sometimes in European dress, and sometimes in a loose shirt hanging over white pantaloons, but always with an expression of tireless, secret delight. As for sleeping, he lay where he chose, under trees, on verandas, in a caravanserai, on temple steps, in the dust among rows of other dust sleepers wrapped, as it were, in shrouds, wherever extreme bodily fatigue laid his down. Nowhere in the crowded city, accustomed to 100 races and innumerable tongues, did he excite the least comment as he wandered through the bazaars, the Arab horse lines, among the toddy groves, in and out of temples, pagodas, churches, mosques, along the strand, among the Hindu funeral pyres, through and through the city,
gazing at the Marathas, Bengalis, Rajputs, Persians, Sikhs, Malays, Siamese, Javans, Filipinos, Kyrgyz, Ethiopians, Parsis, Baghdad Jews, Sinhalese, Tibetans. They gazed back at him when they were not otherwise employed, but with no particular curiosity, no undue attention, certainly no kind of animosity. Sometimes his startlingly pale eyes, even more colourless now against his dusky skin, called for a second wondering glance. And sometimes he was taken for a holy man. Oil was poured on him more than once, and tepid cakes of a sweet vegetable substance were pressed into his hand with smiles. Fruit, a bowl of yellow rice, and he was offered buttered tea, fresh toddy, the juice of sugar cane. Before the partners of the mainmast were renewed, he came home with a wreath of marigolds round his bare, dusty shoulders, an offering from a company of whores. He hung the wreath on the right-hand knob of his blackwood chair and sat down to his journal. I had expected wonders from Bombay, but my heated expectations, founded upon the Arabian Nights, a glimpse of the Moorish towns in Africa, and books of travel, were poor, thin, insubstantial things compared with the reality. There is here a striving, avid, and worldly civilization, of course. These huge and eager markets, this incessant buying and selling, make that self-evident. But I had no conception of the ubiquitous sense of the holy, no notion of how another world can permeate the secular. Filth, stench, disease, gross superstition, as our people say, extreme poverty, promiscuous universal defecation do not affect it, nor do they affect my sense of the humanity with which I am surrounded. What an agreeable city it is, where a man may walk naked in the heat if it pleases him. I was speaking today with an unclothed Hindu religious, a Paramahamsa, on the steps of a Portuguese church, a true gymnosophist. And I remarked that in such a climate, wisdom and clothing might bear an inverse proportion to one another. But measuring my garment with his hand, he observed that there was not one single wisdom. Never have I so blessed this facility for coming by a superficial knowledge of a language. My Fort William grammar, my trifle of Arabic, and above all my intercourse with Ahmed and Butu bear such fruit. Had I been dumb, I might almost as well have been blind also. What is the sight of a violin and the violin lying mute? This dear child Dill teaches me a great deal. Talking indefatigably, a steady flow of comment and narrative with incessant repetition where I do not understand. She insists on being understood, and no evasion deceives her. Though I don't believe Urdu is her mother tongue. She and the crone with whom she lives converse in quite a different language, not a familiar word. The ancient gentlewoman, offering me the child for 12 rupees, assured me that she was a virgin, and wished to show me the fibula that guaranteed her state. It would have been quite superfluous. What could be more virginal than this tubular, fearless creature that looks me directly in the face as though I were a not very intelligent, tame animal, and that communicates her thoughts, views, the moment they are born, as though I too were a child. She can throw a stone, leap, climb like a boy, and yet She is no garçon manqué neither, for in addition to this overflowing communicative affection, she also has a kind of motherliness and wishes to rule my movements and my diet for my own good. Disapproves my smoking bhang, eating opium, wearing trousers of more than a given length. Choleric, however. On Friday she beat a doe-eyed boy who wished to join himself to us in the palm grove, threatening his companions with a brickbat and with oaths that made them stare. She eats voraciously, but how often in the week? She owns one piece of cotton cloth that she wears sometimes as a kilt, sometimes as a shawl, an oiled black stone that she worships perfunctorily, and her fibula. When fed, she is, I believe, perfectly happy, longing only, with no real hope, for a silver bangle. Almost all the children here are encumbered with them and clank as they go. How old is she? 9? 10? The monarchy is not far off. A hint of a bosom, poor child. I'm tempted to purchase her. Above all, I should wish to preserve her in this present state, not sexless, but unaware of her sex, free of her person and of all the gutters and bazaars of Bombay, wholly and immediately human. Wise, too. But only Joshua could halt the sun. In a year's time or less, she will be in a brothel. Would a European house be better? A servant washed and confined? Could I keep her as a pet? For how long? Endow her? It's hard to think of her lively young spirits sinking, vanishing in the common lot. I should advise with Diana. I have a groping notion of some unidentified common quality. This city has immense piety, but old Adam walks about. Bodies I have seen, some starved to death, some clubbed, stabbed, or strangled. And in any mercantile city, one man's evil is another's good. Yet a materialism that would excite no comment in Dublin or Barcelona shocks the stranger in Bombay. I was sitting under the Towers of Silence on Malabar Hill, watching the vultures. Such a view! I had taken Jack's glass, but I didn't need it, they were so very tame. Even the yellow-billed Pharaoh's hen, which, Mr. Norton tells me, is most uncommon west of Hyderabad. And collecting some anomalous bones, when Kawazaji Undertaker spoke to me, a Parsi in a plum-coloured hat. Having come from Mr. Stanhope, I was in European clothes, and he addressed me in English. Did not I know it was forbidden to take up bones? I replied that I was ignorant of the customs of his country, but that I understood the bodies of the dead were exposed upon these towers to be devoured, or taken away piecemeal by vultures, that the bodies thus became bonus nullius, that if property in the flesh could be conceived, then it was vested in the vulture, and that the vulture, relinquishing its title, surely in natural justice gave me a right to this femur, this curiously distorted hyoid, but that I was unwilling to offend any man's opinions, and that I should content myself with contemplating the remains rather than taking them away. My interest was not that of a ghoul, still less that of a glue merchant, but of a natural philosopher. He, too, was a philosopher, he said, the philosophy of number. Should I like to hear him extract a cube root, I might name any figure I pleased. A surprising performance. The answers came as quick as my piece of rib could write them in the dust. He was enchanted, and he would have gone on for ever if I had not mentioned Napier's bones, Gunter's scales, the applied mathematics of navigation,
lunars, the necessary tables. Here I ventured out of my depth, was unable to satisfy him as to their nature, and therefore proposed carrying him to the ship. His curiosity overcame his evident alarm. He was gratified by the attention, pleased with the instrument, and on returning to land he invited me to drink tea at his counting-house. He is a considerable merchant. Here, at my request, he gave me a succinct account of his life, and I was disappointed but not surprised to find him a complacent, pragmatical, worldly fellow. Little do I know of the mathematics or the law, but the few mathematicians and lawyers I have met seem to me to partake of this sterility in direct proportion to their eminence. It may be that they are satisfied with an insufficient, or in the case of lawyers, almost wholly factitious order. However that may be, this man appears to have turned his benevolent ancient creed into an arid system of mechanical observances. So many hours devoted to stated ceremonies, so much of acknowledged income set aside for alms, no question of charity here, I believe, and a rancorous hatred for the Kadmis, who disagree with his sect, the Shen Shahis, not on any point of doctrine, but over the dating of their era. I might have been in Seething Lane. I do not imagine he's a typical Parsi, however, in anything but his alert, painstaking attention to business. Among other things, he is an insurer, a maritime insurer, and he spoke of the rise in premiums, plotting them against the movements, or the rumoured movements, of Linois' squadron, an armament that fills not only the company with alarm, but also all the country ships. Premiums are now higher than they were in Suffren's time. His family has innumerable commercial interests. Tibetan borax, Benkulin nutmeg, Tuticorin pearls, my memory retains. A cousin's banking house is closely connected with the office of the commissioners for the former French settlements. He could have told me a great deal about them if it had not been for his sense of caution. Even so, he spoke with some freedom of Richard Canning, for whom he expressed respect and esteem. He told me little I didn't already know, but he did confirm that their return was set for the 17th. He could tell me nothing about the Hindu ceremony on the shores of the bay this coming moon. Neither cared nor knew. For this, I must turn once again to Dil, though indeed her notions of religion are so eclectic as to lead her into confusion. God will not be merciful to him who through vanity wears long trousers, she tells me. A Muslim teaching. And at the same time she takes it for an acknowledged truth that I am a werebear, a decayed werebear out of a place, an inept, rustic demon that has strayed into the city, and that I can certainly fly if I choose, but with a blundering flight, neither efficient nor in the right direction. A belief she must have taken from the Tibetans. She is right in supposing that I need guidance, however. The 17th. If Jack is accurate in his calculations, and in these matters I have never known him fail, I should have 3 weeks before the ship is ready. I am impatient for their arrival now, although when we came in I more than half dreaded it. What a wonderful interlude this has been. A piece of my life lifted quite out. "Why, there you are, Stephen," cried Jack. "You'll come home, I find." "That is true," said Stephen with an affectionate look. He prized statements of this kind in Jack. "So are you, Joy, and earlier than usual. Do you look perturbed? Do you find the heat affect you? Take off some of those splendid garments." "Why, no, not more than common," said Jack, unbuckling his sword. "Though it is hellfire hot and close and damp. No, I looked in on the off chance I had to dine with the Admiral, as you know, and there I heard something that made my blood run cold, and I thought I ought to tell you. Diana Villiers is here, and that man Canning. By God, I wish the ship were ready for sea. I couldn't stand the meeting. Ain't you amazed? Shocked? No, no, truly I'm not. And for my part, I must tell you, Jack, I look forward to the meeting extremely. They are not, in fact, in Bombay, but they are expected on the 17th. You knew she was here? Cried Jack. Stephen nodded. You are a close one, Stephen, said Jack, looking at him sideways. Stephen shrugged. He said, Yes, I suppose I am. I have to be, you know. That's why I'm alive. And one's mind takes the bent. But I beg your pardon if I've not been as free and open with you as I should have been. This is delicate ground, however. There was a time when they were rivals. When Jack felt so strongly about Diana that this was very dangerous ground indeed. Jack had nearly wrecked his career because of her and his chance of marrying Sophia. In retrospect, he resented it bitterly, just as he resented her unfaithfulness, although she owed him no fidelity. He hated her in a way. He thought her dangerous, if not evil. And he dreaded an encounter. Dreaded it for Stephen, more than for himself. No, no, my dear fellow, not at all, he said, shaking Stephen by the hand. No, I'm sure you're right, in keeping your counsel, I mean. After a pause, Stephen said, And yet I'm surprised you should not have heard of their presence, if not in England, then here. I have been regaled with accounts of their cohabitation at every dinner I've attended, every tea-drinking, almost every casual encounter with a European. He had indeed. The coming of Richard Canning and Diana Villiers had been a godsend to Bombay, bored as it was with the Gujarat famine and the endless talk of a Maratha war. Canning had an important official position, he had great influence with the company, and he lived in splendour. He was an active, stirring man, ready and eager to take up any challenge, and he made it clear that he expected their ménage to be accepted. Several of the highly placed officials had known her father, and those with Indian concubines made no difficulty, nor did the bachelors. But the European wives were harder to persuade. Few had much room to cast stones, but hypocrisy has never failed the English middle class in any latitude, and they flung them in plenty with delighted, shocked abandon. Rocks, boulders, limited in size only by fear for their husband's advancement. Conciliating discretion had never been among Mrs. Villiers' qualities, and if subjects for malignant gossip had been wanting, she would have provided them by the elephant load. Canning spent much of his time in the French possessions and in Goa, and during his absence the good ladies kept telescopes trained on Diana's house. With extravagant lamentation they mourned the death of Mr. James of the 87th Foot, killed by Captain MacFarlane, the wounding of a member of council, and less important hostilities. These affairs were spoken of with religious horror, while the many other quarrels in that liverish, overfed, parboiled community, much given to murder by consent, were passed over as amiable weaknesses, the natural consequence of the heat. Mr. Canning was of a jealous disposition, and unsigned letters kept him informed of Diana's visitors, imaginary and real. "Sir! Sir!" cried Babington on the veranda. In his strong voice, Jack called out, "Hello!" The staircase trembled, the door burst open, and Babington's smile appeared in the gloom. It faded at the sight of his captain's harsh expression.
"'What are you doing ashore, Babington?' asked Jack. "'Two pairs of shrouds cut in the eyes and you're ashore?'
"'Why, sir, the governor's colipar brought the mail, "'and I thought you might choose to see it right away.'
"'Well,' said Jack, the gloom lightening, "'there is something in what you say.' He grasped the bag and hurried into the next room, coming out a few moments later with a packet for Stephen, and disappearing again.
"'Well, sir,' said Babington, "'I mustn't keep you.'
"'You mustn't keep your strumpet, either,' said Stephen, glancing out of the window.
"'Oh, sir,' cried Babington, "'she's not a strumpet. She's a clergyman's daughter.'
"'Then why do you perpetually borrow important sums of money "'from the only person in the ship weak enough to lend them to you? "'Two pagodas last week, 4 rupees 6 pice the week before.'
"'Oh, but she only lets her friends, her friend, help her with the rent. "'It's somewhat in arrears. "'I put up there, you know, when I can get ashore, which is precious rare. "'But it is true, you have been very good to me, sir.'
You do. You do.
Well, let me tell you this, Mr. Babington. Such things can lead very far, and clergymen are not all they seem.
You will remember what I told you about Gumata and the third generation. Many an example may be seen in the bazaars. How should you like to see your grandson bald, stunted, and gibbering, toothless and decrepit before the age of 12? I beg you to take care. Any woman is a source of great potential danger to a sailorman.
Oh, I will, sir, I will, cried Babington, who had been peering secretly through the slatted blind. But, do you know, sir, it's the most ridiculous thing. I seem to have left the ship without any money in my pocket.
Stephen listened to him hurtling down the stairs, sighed, and turned to his letters.
Sir Joseph was concerned almost entirely with beetles of one kind or another. He would be infinitely grateful if his dear Maturin, happening to stumble upon any of the bupestrids, would remember him. But an enigmatic postscript gave him the key to Mr. Waring's letter, which seemed to be about a stupid, quarrelsome, litigious set of common acquaintances, but which, in fact, gave him a view of the political situation. In Catalonia, British military intelligence was backing the wrong horse, as usual. In Lisbon, the embassy was having conversations with still another dubious representative of the resistance. There was danger of a schism in the movement, and they longed for his return. News from his private agent. Mrs. Canning was making her preparations for a voyage to India to confront her husband. The Mokattas had found out that he was obliged to be in Calcutta before the next rains, and she was to travel in the Warren Hastings, bound for that uncomfortable port. Sophie had omitted to date 3 of her letters with anything more definite than the day of the week, and he opened them in the wrong order. His first impression was that of time entirely dislocated. Cecilia, placidly expecting a baby, how I look forward to being an aunt, without any apparent sacrifice of her maidenhead or adverse comment from her friends. Francis, removed to the desolate shores of Loch Erne, and there shivering in the company of somebody called Lady F, and longing for the return of one Sir O. A second reading made the situation clearer. Both Sophie's younger sisters had married, Cecilia to a young militia officer, and Frances, emulating her sister's triumph. "'How she must have changed,' said Stephen, "'to this soldier's much older cousin, an Ulster landowner who represented County Antrim at Westminster, while Frances lived with his aged mother at Floodsville, drinking confusion to the Pope twice a day in elderberry wine. There was joy, even exultation at her sister's happiness. Cecilia, at least, adored the marriage state. It was even more fun than she'd expected, although they were only in lodgings at Gosport, and would have to stay there until Sir Oliver could be induced to do something for his cousin. And a detailed description of their weddings, conducted with great propriety and in splendid weather, by Mr. Hinksey, their own dear vicar, being from home. But they were not really happy letters. They were not the letters he would have liked to read. A third reading convinced him that Cecilia's marriage had been tolerably hasty, that Mrs. Williams had been obliged to yield on all fronts, the brisk young soldier having undermined her citadel, but that she had had her way with Sir Oliver Flood, a wealthy man and a dreary. And this third reading confirmed his impression of despondency. Mrs. Williams's spirits had revived with the excitement of the marriages and her victory over Sir Oliver's attorney, but now her health was on the wane again, and she complained much of her loneliness. Now that she and Sophia were alone, she had reduced the number of her servants, had shut up the tower wing, and had given up entertaining. Almost their only visitor was Mr. Hinksey, who dropped in every other day or so, and who dined with them whenever he took Mr. Fellowes's duty. Now that there was nothing else to occupy her mind, she renewed her persecution of Sophia, volubly when she was well, in pale gasps when she was confined to her bed. And the strange thing is that although I hear his name so very often, Mr. Hinksey is a real comfort to me. He's a truly friendly man and a good man, as I was sure he would be from your recommendation of him. He thinks so highly of dear unworldly Dr. Maturin, and you would blush, I'm sure, to hear us speaking about you, as we so often do. He never obtrudes his feelings or distresses me, and he is as kind as can be to my mamma, even when she is not quite discreet. He preaches exceedingly well, no enthusiasm or hard words, and no, what I suppose you would call, eloquence, either. And it's a pleasure to hear him even when he speaks of duty, which he does pretty often. And I must say, he practices what he preaches. He's the most dutiful son. It makes me feel wretched and ashamed. His mother... Stephen didn't care about old Mrs. Hinksey. She was a beautiful old lady, so kind and gentle, but perfectly deaf. "Humbug. The woman can hear quick enough if she chooses," said Stephen. "All these unscrupulous advantages and white hair, too." He skipped to the part that worried him most. Sophia found it very strange that Jack had not written. "Why, you fat-headed girl, cannot you see that a man of war must outfly the swiftest post?" She was sure that Jack would never, never do anything unkind on purpose. But the best of men were thoughtless and forgetful at times, particularly when they had a great deal to do, like the captain of a man of war. And there was the old saying about distance and salt water doing away with other feelings. Nothing was more natural than a man should grow tired of an ignorant country girl like Sophia, that even quite ardent feelings should wear out in a man who had so many other things to think of and such high responsibilities. Above all, she didn't wish to be a clog on Jack, either in his career — Lord St. Vincent was dead set against marriage — or in anything else. He might have friends in India, and she would be perfectly miserable if, because of her, he felt himself bound or in any way entangled.
"The catalyst in all this is the general," observed Stephen, comparing the letter with earlier examples of Sophie's hand. "It is wrote hasty and in some agitation of spirit. The spelling is even poorer than usual."
Sophie passed it off as a trifling incident, but her amusement was forced and unconvincing. General Aubrey, together with Jack's new stepmother, a jolly, vulgar young woman, until recently a dairymaid, and their little boy, had descended upon Mapes. Fortunately, at a time when Mrs. Williams was in Canterbury with Mrs. Hinksey. Sophie gave them the best dinner she could, with several bottles of wine, alas. General Aubrey belonged to another civilization, a civilization untouched by the Age of Enlightenment or the spread of the bourgeoisie, one that had passed away in the counties nearer London long before Sophie was born, and one to which her essentially urban, respectable, middle-class family had never belonged at any time. She had been brought up in a quiet, staid, manless house, and she didn't know what to make of his gallantries, his praise of Jack's taste. Cecilia would have been more at home with him, nor of his observation that Jack was a sad dog, always had been, but she was not to mind it, Jack's mother never had. Sophia wouldn't mind half a dozen love children, he was sure. General Aubrey was not a disreputable man. He was kind and well-bred in his camp-and-country way, but he was chuckle-headed and impulsive, and when he was nervous, Sophia had no idea that a man of nearly 70 could be shy, and in wine he felt he had to be talking. His outre facetiousness, his broad, earthy pleasantry shocked her extremely, and it seemed to her a coarse, licentious, rakish, unprincipled caricature of his son. Her only consolation was that the general and her mother had not come into contact, and that her mother had not seen the second Mrs. Aubrey. She remembered the general's loud, candid voice, so reminiscent of his son's, calling out from the end of the long table that Jack had not a groat to bless himself with, never would have. All the Aubreys were unlucky with money, they had to be lucky in marriage. She remembered the endless pause after dinner, with the little boy poking holes in the fire screen, the concentrated urgency with which she willed the general to have done with his bottle, to come in, drink his tea, and go away before her mother's return, now long overdue. She remembered how she and the laughing Mrs. Aubrey had supported him into the carriage, the interminable farewells, the general recalling some endless anecdote about a fox chase and losing himself in it, while the child played havoc with the flower beds, shrieking like a barn owl. Then, 10 minutes later, while she was still shattered, her mother's return, the scene, the cries, tears, swooning, bed, extreme pallor, reproaches.
"Stephen! I say, Stephen, I ain't interrupting you, am I?" said Jack, coming out of his room with a letter in his hand. "Here's a damn thing. Here's Sophie writing me the damnedest rigmarole. I can't show it to you, some very private things in it, you understand me? But the drift of it is that if I choose to feel myself free, nothing would make her happier. Free to do what, in God's name? God damn and blast my eyes, we're engaged to be married, aren't we? If it were any other woman on earth, I should think there was some other man hanging about. What the devil can she mean by it? Can you make head or tail of it? It may be that someone has fabricated... It may be that someone has told her that you have come to India to see Diana Villiers," said Stephen, hiding his face with shame as he spoke. This was a direct attempt at keeping them apart for his own purposes. Partly for his own purposes. It was wholly uncandid, of course, and he had never been uncandid with Jack before. It filled him with anger, but still he went on, "Or that you may see her here." "Did she know Diana was in Bombay?" cried Jack. "Sure, it was common knowledge in England." "So Mother Williams knew?" Stephen nodded. "Ah, that's Sophie from Clue to Earring," cried Jack with such a radiant smile. "Can you imagine a sweeter thing to say, and such modesty, do you see, as if anyone could look at Diana after... However," he said, recollecting himself and looking deprecatingly at Stephen, "I don't mean to say anything wrong or uncivil, but not a reproach, not an unkind word in the whole letter. Lord, Stephen, how I love that girl!" His bright blue eyes clouded, ran over, and he wiped them with his sleeve. "Never a hint of being ill-used. Though I know damn well what kind of life that woman leads her, to say nothing of filling her mind with ugly tales. A shocking life. You know Cecilia and Frankie are gone off, married. That makes it even worse. Lord, I shall press on with the refitting, even faster now. I long to get back into the Atlantic or the Med. These are not waters where a man can look for any distraction now, far less any wealth. If only we'd picked up a single decent prize off the Isle of France, I should write to her to come out to Madeira and be damned to... A few hundred would buy us a neat cottage. How I should love a neat cottage, Stephen. Potatoes, cabbages and things. Upon my word, I cannot tell why you do not write, prize or no prize. You have your pay for all, love. Oh, that wouldn't be right, you know. I'm nearly clear of debt, but there's still a couple of thousand to find. Would scarcely be honourable to pay it off with her fortune and then only have 7 shillings a day to offer her. Do you pretend to teach me the difference between honourable and dishonourable conduct? No, no, of course not. Pray don't fly out at me, Stephen. I've spoke awkward again. No, what I mean is it wouldn't be right for me, do you understand? I couldn't bear it to have Mrs. Williams call me a fortune hunter. It's different in Ireland, I know. Oh, damn it, I'm laid by the lee again. I mean, I do not mean you are a fortune hunter, but you see it differently in your country. Outre pay, outre mad. But in any case, she swore never to marry without her mother's consent, so that claps a stopper over all. Never in life, my dear. If Sophie comes to Madeira, Mrs. Williams will be bound either to give her consent or to face a delighted neighbourhood. She was obliged to the same course in the case of Cecilia, I believe. Would not that be rather Jesuitical, Stephen? Said Jack, looking into his face. Not at all. Consent unreasonably withheld may justifiably be compelled. I am concerned with Sophie's happiness and yours, rather than with pandering to Mrs. Williams's sordid whims. You must write that letter, Jack, for you're to consider Sophie is the beauty of the world, whereas, although you are tolerably well-looking in your honest, tartan way, you are rather old and likely to grow older. Too fat and likely to grow even fatter. Nay, obese. Jack looked at his belly and shook his head. Horribly knocked about. Earless. Scarred. Brother... You are no Adonis. Do not be wounded, he said, laying his hand on Aubrey's knee, when I say you are no Adonis. I never thought I was, said Jack. Nor when I add that you are no fox, either. No flashing wit to counterbalance want of looks, wealth, grace, and youth. Sure, I never set up for a wit, said Jack. Though I can bring out a good thing on occasion, given time. And Sophie, I say again, has real beauty. And there are Adonises, witty, moneyed Adonises in England. Again, she's led a devil of a life. 2 younger sisters have married. You're aware of the importance of marriage to a young woman. The status, the escape, the certified guarantee of not having failed, the virtuous certainty of a genteel subsistence. You are a great way off, 10,000 miles and more. You may be knocked on the head from one moment to the next, and at no time is there more than a 2-inch plank between you and the grave. You are half the world away from her, and yet within 1/2 mile of Diana.
She knows little or nothing of the world, little or nothing of men, apart from what her mother tells her, small good, you may be sure. Lastly, there is her high sense of duty. Now, although Sophie carries humanity to a high pitch of perfection, no young woman more, still, she is human, and she is affected by human considerations. I do not say for a moment that she coldly weighs them up, but considerations, the pressures, are there, and they are very strong. You must certainly write your letter, Jack. Take pen and ink. Jack gazed at him for a while with a heavy, troubled countenance, then stood up, sighed, pulled in his belly, and said, "I must go down to the yard. We're shipping the new capstan this evening. Thank you for what you told me, Stephen." It was Stephen who took pen and ink and sat down to his diary. "I must go down to the yard," said he. "We are stepping the new capstan this evening." Had there been powder smoke in the room, a tangible enemy at hand, there would have been none of this hesitation, no long stare. He would have known his mind, and he would have acted at once with intelligent deliberation. But now he's at a stand. With that odious freedom, I prattled on. In doing so, I overcame my shame, but it was bitter cruel and sharp while it lasted. In the instant between his asking, could I make head or tail of it, and my reply, the devil said to me, "If Aubrey is really vexed with Miss Williams, he will turn to Diana Villiers again. You already have your work cut out with Mr. Canning." I fell at once. Yet already I have almost persuaded myself that my subsequent words were the same as those an honest man would have used. Myself, if this attachment had not existed. Liaison, I cannot say, since liaison implies a mutual attraction, and I have no sort of evidence for this other than my oh-so-fallible intuition. I long for the 17th. Already I am beginning to murder time like an ardent boy. Such an ugly crime. The sea festival will perhaps knock 6 innocent hours on the head. The ceremony took place all along the shore of Back Bay, from Malabar Point to the fort. And the broad park-like stretch of grass before the fort was one of the best places for viewing the preparations. Like all Hindu ceremonies he'd seen, this appeared to be going forward with great excitement, great good humour, and a total lack of organisation. There were some groups already on the strand, with their leaders standing waist-deep, wafting flowers into the sea. But most of the inhabitants of Bombay seemed to have gathered here on the green to mill about in their best clothes, laughing, singing, beating drums, eating sweetmeats and sauces of cooked food from tiny stalls, breaking off now and then to form a vague procession, chanting a shrill and powerful hymn. Great warmth, an infinite variety of smells and colours, the bray of conches, deep hooting trumpets, countless people, and winding in and out among the people, elephants with crowded castles on their backs, bullock carts, hundreds and hundreds of palanquins, horsemen, holy cows, European carriages. A warm hand slipped into his, and looking down, Stephen saw Dil smiling up at him. "Art very strangely clothed, Stephen," she said. "I almost took thee for a topiwala. I have a whole leaf of pondu. Come and eat it before it spills. Mind thy good bazaar shirt in the dung. It is far too long, thy shirt." She led him across the trampled grass to the rising glassy of the fort, and there, finding an empty place, they sat down. "Lean thy head forward," she said, unfolding the leaf and setting the turgid mess between them. "Nay, nay, forward, more forward. Dost thou not see thy shirt all slobbered? Oh, for shame, where wast thou brought up? What mother bore thee? Forward!" Despairing of making him eat like a human being, she stood up, licked his shirt clean,
And then, folding her brown, jointless legs under her, she squatted close in front of him.
"Open thy mouth."
With an expert hand, she moulded the pondu into little balls and fed him.
"Close thy mouth, Stephen. Swallow. Open. There, Maharaj. Another. There, my garden of nightingales. Open. Close."
The sweet, gritty, unctuous mass flowed into him, and all the time Dill's voice rose and fell.
"Thou canst not eat much better than a bear. Swallow. Pause now and belch. Dost not know how to belch? Thus. I can belch whenever I choose. Belch twice. Look, look, the Mahratta chiefs."
A splendid group of horsemen, in crimson, with gold-embroidered turbans and saddle-cloths.
"That is the Peshwa in the middle, and there the Bonsly Raja. Ha-ha, my dayo! Another ball and all is gone. Open. Thou hast 15 teeth above, and one less below. There's a European carriage filled with Franks. Pah! I can smell them from here, stronger than camels. They eat cow and pig. It's perfectly notorious. Thou hast no more skill in eating with thy fingers than a bear or a Frank, poor Stephen. Art thou a Frank at times?"
Her eyes were fixed upon him with alert, penetrating curiosity. But before he could reply, they darted off to an approaching line of elephants, so covered with housings, paint, howdahs, and tinsel, that below nothing could be seen but their feet shuffling in the dust, and before nothing but their gilt, silver-banded tusks and questing trunks.
"I shall sing thee the Marvari hymn to Krishna," said Dil,
and began in a nasal whine, slicing the air with her right hand as she sang. Another elephant crossed in front of them, a trim pole set up on the howdah, bearing a streamer that read Revenge as it floated on the breeze. Most of the ship's starboard maintopmen were there, clinging to one another in a tight mass, while their larboard colleagues ran behind, calling out that they had had their spellmates and fair was fair. A competing elephant from the Galia, almost hidden by a mass of delighted seamen in shore-going rig, white sennit hats and ribbons. Mr. Smith, a sea officer of the small, trim, brisk, round-headed port wine kind, once shipmates with Stephen in the Lively and now second in the Goliath, rode by on a camel, with his legs folded negligently over the creature's neck to the manner born. He cut nimbly between the elephant and the bank, with his face at Stephen's level, some 15 feet away. The Goliaths roared out to Mr. Smith, waving bottles and cheering, and Smith waved back to them. His mouth could be seen opening and closing, but no sound pierced through the din. Dil sang on, hypnotized by her unvarying chant and the flow of words. More and more Europeans appeared, now that the day was growing cooler. Carriages of every kind, and its reputable drove of midshipmen from the Revenge and the Goliath mounted on little Arab horses, asses, and an astonished bullock. More and more Europeans, and incomparably more Hindus, for now the climax was coming near. The strand was almost covered with white-robed brown figures, and the sound of horns drowned the low thunder of the sea. Yet even so, the crowds on the green grew thicker still, and now the carriages advanced at a walk, when they advanced at all, rising dust, heat, merriment, and above all this immense activity, the kites and vultures wheeled in the untroubled sky, effortless rings higher and higher, the highest losing themselves at last, black specks that vanished in the blue. Dil sang on and on. Bringing his eyes down from the vultures and the glare, Stephen found himself looking directly into Diana's face. She was sitting in a barouche under the shade of two apricot-coloured umbrellas with three officers, leaning forward with lively interest to see what had stopped them. Immediately in front of the carriage, two bullock carts had locked their wheels together. The drivers stood there shouting at one another, while the bullocks leant inwards together against the yoke, closing their eyes, and from behind the shutters the Purdah ladies shrieked abuse, advice, and orders. With a dense procession filing by forever on the right-hand side, and the steep slope of the glacis on the left, it was clear that the barouche would have to wait until the bullocks were disentangled. She twisted round with a movement Stephen had forgotten, but that was as familiar as the beat of his heart. The servants, perched behind with the umbrellas, ducked and swerved to give her a better view, but there was no retreat through the crowd, and she sat back in her seat, saying something to the man opposite her that made him laugh, and the apricot shadow swept over them again. She was, if anything, better looking than when he had seen her last. She was a little too far from him, to be sure, but it seemed that the climate, her almost native climate, which turned so many Englishmen yellow, had been kind to her, bringing to her a glow that he hadn't seen in England. At all events, that remembered perfection of movement was there. Nothing studied about that sinuous turn, nothing that loosened all his judgment so. "What is amiss with thee?" asked Dill, breaking off and looking up at him. "Nothing," said Stephen, staring still. "Art sick," she cried, standing up and spreading her hands upon his heart. "No," said Stephen. He smiled at her and shook his head. He was quite composed. She squatted, still staring up, and Diana, looking quickly from side to side, made some mechanical, smiling reply to her neighbour's remark. Her eyes swept along the glacis, passed over Stephen, suddenly returned and paused with a growing look of doubt, and then the most extreme astonishment, and all at once her face changed to frank delight. It flushed, turned pale. She opened the door and sprang to the ground, leaving astonishment behind her. She ran up the slope, and Stephen, rising, stepped over Dill and took her by her outstretched hands. "Stephen! Upon my soul and honour," she cried. "Stephen, how glad I am to see you!"
"I'm glad to see you too, my dear," he said, grinning like a boy.
"But in God's name, how come you to be here?"
"By sea, by ship, the usual way. Brief explanations cut again and again by amazement. 10,000 miles. Health, looks, mutual civilities. Unabashed staring, smiles. How very, very brown you are. Your skin is fairer than I saw at last," he said. "Stephen," muttered Dill again.
"Who is your sweet companion?" asked Diana. "Allow me to name Dill, my particular friend and guide."
"Stephen, tell the woman to take her foot from off my carter," said Dill with a stony look.
"Oh, daughter, I beg thou wilt forgive me,"
cried Diana, bending and brushing the dust off Dill's rag.
"Oh, how sorry I am. If it's spoilt, thou shalt have a sari made of Golkan silk with two gold threads."
Dill looked at the trodden place. She said, "It will pass," and added, "Thou dost not smell like a Frank." Diana smiled and wafted her handkerchief at the child, spreading the scent of attar from oud.
"Pray take it, Dilgudaz," she said. "Take it, melter of hearts, and dream of Sivaji."
Dil writhed her head away, the conflict between pleasure and displeasure plain on her averted face.
but pleasure won. And she took the handkerchief for the supple, pretty bow, flunked the Begum Lala, and smote it voluptuously.